gentlemen, welcome to the Solari Report. This is Money and Markets with John Titus at Catherine Austin Fitz. And we are clearly in a state of high amusement about what is going on in the world. It's April 10th, and we're recording for tomorrow. We'll publish on Thursday, April 11th. And our theme is a barn burner. John found it, and it gives you tremendous insight into what's really going on. So, John, our theme is?
Well, the official theme, which you'll see in a segment, is scapegoat capitalism, but we may have to massage that to patsy capitalism.
You just came up with the patsy capitalism notion, and I think that just nails it. Anyway, let's dive in.
Yeah, okay. Like I say, there's a clip where we see patsy capitalism at work. But let's dive in. We'll actually run into scapegoat capitalism before we get to the clip. But anyway, let's go to the story, starting with genocide in Gaza. Not a lot's changed here. There have been some talks of truce. Hopes for Eid truce dashed. You might have heard that there were talks of a truce. Eid, I think, is the last couple days of Ramadan, which is coming to an end. But there's going to be no truce. Hamas officials told Reuters that no progress was made in the negotiations. There is no change in the position of the Israeli occupation, and therefore there is nothing new in the Cairo talks, said the Hamas official. And there's no surprise there, because genocide is an all-in proposition.
So I want to emphasize something I've said before, which is the U.S. empire has extraordinary technology to deal with underground tunneling and underground bases and underground travel transportation. So the notion that we have to destroy the upstairs infrastructure because we can't do anything about the hostages underground is the biggest story of baloney I've just about ever heard. And, you know, we're back to the old thing. We're going to either Egypt takes these 2 million people or we kill them, because we're going to take their land. We're going to take their stuff. And we want the oil and gas in the Mediterranean for Europe. And that's it. It's that simple. And we want to start a war with Iran. So,
yeah,
you know, and here's the thing.
And we'll get to that, too. Yep.
Right. If they can get away with this, you know, your neighborhood is coming. So
absolutely. You're on the menu, too.
You're on the menu.
Make no mistake about that.
Right. And if they can do it to these folks, they can do it to you and will. So that's where we are with this.
Yeah. Let's cut on genocide in Gaza to the U.S., where we find that we have no political candidates on any part of the spectrum who don't get behind Israel. So this is Tulsi Gabbard, the peace candidate. And you are going to hear her victim blaming and also engaging in some scapegoat capitalism herself. Let's listen to Tulsi and what she has to say about the victims here.
When you listen to that Sky News reporter and the question that she asked, she's emblematic of this broader issue we're seeing with many so-called reporters who aren't just reporting facts, but instead essentially doing Hamas's work for them. Mm-hmm. Hamas's goal is to turn the world against Israel in order to reach their objective goal and the goal of other Islamist groups and countries, frankly, which is wipe Israel off the face of the earth. They're succeeding in doing that by using these reporters who have become their propagandists.
Yeah.
And those who are naturally compassionate by nature are hearing this and hearing things that are not representative of the truth and falling for it and turning against Israel and not actually seeing the truth of how Islamists and terrorist groups like Hamas, as you know, ISIS and Al-Qaeda and others, they have always used civilians as human shields.
Okay, so we're clear. Women and children dying over there, that's their fault, number one. And number two, it's because ISIS and Al-Qaeda, the CIA bogeyman, the CIA scapegoat patsies, they always use human shields. And that's why we have to shoot them. So good job, Tulsi, there, trotting out those CIA talking points. Good girl.
If you really deep dive and study World War II, it gives you a perfect example of how war works. The same people are on both sides, and it's a theater, and they ping pong back and forth. And part of that ping pong is to justify doing whatever they want to do, which is killing all the patsies. So,
do you know any people in the theater on the Palestinian side in the U.S.? I can't think of any.
Oh yeah, I do.
There's not Trump, it's not Biden, it's not RFK, and
oh, nobody making their case. And right. And what Gabbard is talking about are people who are describing both sides of the story. But remember, the goal is to get people worked up in both sides of the story. So we have the same group of people who killed, I don't know how many people in Israel they killed during the pandemic, but a lot. And now they're killing the Palestinians. And the goal is to do a divide and conquer between the two. That's part of the theater. So
yeah.
Anyway, but you know, here's the thing: no politician at the federal level, with rare exception, is now talking about facts. That's
right.
Right.
Right. Right. That's right. Exactly
we're part of the theater. We're part of the show.
Right. Right. But Tulsi there trots out. When the whole October 7th got started, you know, we trotted out that Golda Meir quote: "We will never forgive you for forcing us to kill your children." And that's part and parcel. It's like your fault. It's the victim's fault. It's always victim's fault. And it's always the other side's fault. And we're the victim no matter what we're doing. Even when we're shooting your babies in the back, we're the victim. You're forcing us to do that.
I just did this, News Trends and Stories with Farrell. And Farrell has studied, you know, he has this PhD from Oxford in patristics. And he's studied Christian theology for centuries, you know, going back to the split between the Russian Orthodox Church and the church. And what he has pointed out, and I think it's in part two, which we published next week, we did part one this week, is that when Christian scholarship said, Israel is the chosen people, Israel was the church, which was everywhere. It wasn't a place in the Middle East. It wasn't a geographical location. And yet that has been twisted into, you know, an extraordinary amount of the Christians in America supporting this genocide on the theory that it's Israel. And this is all, you know, so there's been a migration, and I would suggest it's by the Anglo-American Alliance, of Israel from the church to Israel from, to a place in the Middle East that justifies all this kind of stuff. And it's interesting because Tucker Carlson just had a Christian priest from, I think, Jerusalem or from Israel on his show talking about how every time the American Empire runs around and does these kind of things, they also kill off and destroy the Christians. So there is a process, John, where the hypocrisy that's been using to justify this form of Patsy capitalism is coming to a head. That's part of what the hate crimes legislation is all about, to stop it from coming to a head. But nothing will stop it because, you know, the sane have decided they've had it with the insane, and including using biblical, using scripture to justify their insanity.
Yes, the eschatology of it all.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Okay, well, you mentioned the lack of reality at the federal level. Let's let's turn with that on that theme to Ukraine, where we're starting to see some cracks in the narrative, in the edifice. This is Politico, so it's a mainstream publication. Ukraine is at great risk of its front lines. What's that word? Collapsing. Wow, that's pretty strong. I thought this was a slam dunk. This is an interesting article. It adds an interesting nugget to this whole thing. According to high-ranking Ukrainian military officers who served under General Zelensky, okay, so that's who they're interviewing to get this information here, and that's who this quote is from. Quote, "There's nothing that can help Ukraine now because there are no serious technologies able to compensate Ukraine for the large mass of troops Russia is likely to hurl at us. We don't have those technologies, and the West doesn't have them as well in sufficient numbers," one of the top-ranking guys said. But here's the new information. Zelensky used to call it the war of one chance, one of the officers says. By that, he meant weapon systems become redundant very quickly because they're quickly countered by the Russians. For example, we use Storm Shadow and Scalp cruise missiles successfully, but just for a short time. The Russians are always studying. They don't give us a second chance, and they're successful in this. So good luck with your new technologies, because they're going to work once and then you're done.
So what I keep hearing two things. So I talked to people in the Netherlands, Germany, and France, several other countries in Europe last week and earlier this week. And what they all said is the message to them in the media is Ukraine is winning. We're going to win this war. Meantime, the message from people on the ground, such as we just got, but also from American military people watching this, is money can't help now.
Right.
You know, you're too far collapsed and you're too outgunned to be able to do anything. And then the big question mark is, how far will the Russians try to advance? What will they do? But basically, the West is completely outgunned, and except their media. So this could get very, very ugly. And of course, we see Blinken and a whole group of people trying to talk Ukraine into NATO so we can start a war. But it's a war we're going to lose.
So that's one move, is try to start a war. Broaden the front of the Ukrainian war out to the bigger theater. The other option we've seen, and we saw it last week in abundance, was just random acts of terrorism, bombing civilian infrastructure, bombing malls, terror incidents in malls, just terror, terror, terror. The U.S. is a terrorist organization. We're seeing that. It's not working.
No, it's not working, because all it's doing is inspiring sort of a general mood of lawlessness and fear.
Right.
So, you know, but I will say this, the only Blinken twice, and including last week, had to go to Brussels by car because his Boeing airplane wouldn't work.
Right. That's the second time for him in the Boeing airplane not working, by the way.
Right. So if the Secretary of State's airplane can't fly, how are you supposed to wage a land war in Europe?
Right. Not to mention,
how are you supposed to wage a land war with Iran, or a nuclear war with Iran that Netanyahu is trying to start? How are you going to do that? There is only one reason you would do that, and this is why you've got Mark Zuckerberg and everybody else building bunkers in Hawaii. The only reason you would want to do that is you want to depopulate the West. That is the only reason why you would do that I can think of.
Right. Of course, I can't think of any other reasons either.
Well, they're insane. Insanity is another explanation.
Yeah, but that's not a reason.
Right. Right.
You know, not really. It's not a motivation.
Right.
It's an explanation, but it's not a motivation. Right.
Right. So I hate to say it, the American people have now tolerated this machinery genociding a lot of people in Gaza and a lot of people in the Ukraine. And the message to Mr. Global is, okay, well, you're on the menu too.
Yeah. You mentioned lawlessness too, which is certainly a part of it. And we saw that last week with the bombing by Israel of essentially the Syrian embassy. We're getting more of that. We're going to see that this week too.
Right.
It's just a spiral out of control.
To me, the greatest lawlessness is what Yellen did. So everybody should watch your video. So Yellen's saying she's going to grab the Russian assets.
Did you see the Chinese gift to Yellen when she was over there?
No. What was it?
They gave Yellen a plate with a picture of her, you know, her bust on it, her head and shoulders. So it's like a head on a platter.
Oh, my God.
That's what I'm told. Anyway.
I didn't see that. That's scary.
That is scary. It's scary. And she's like, oh, thank you. Thank you. Okay, let's go to the signature clip, to the thematic clip of scapegoat capitalism or patsy capitalism. This guy here on the right is the professor who's speaking, Fabio Vigi. And I knew that name rang a bell, and I went and tracked him down. And in 2021, he actually gave Catherine and me props for the work we were doing on the Going Direct Reset with, you know, Larry Fink and Carstens and the gang. And so this clip here, he's been working on this theory of scapegoat capitalism for a few years. And I found this really interesting. And it's an excellent summary of how the world is working right now. So let's listen to Fabio.
So emergency capitalism is a concept that I've developed now for about 4 years, obviously starting in 2020. Maybe we can go back to that later. But the overall idea is that we are now in a system which relies on crisis. And it's a debt-based, hyper-financialized system that can only prolong itself, can only continue, insofar as it can find alibis or scapegoats which are traumatic in nature, let's say. So it needs almost an endless series of emergencies, ideally global emergencies, to be able to reproduce itself. So it's really a matter of existential reproduction for the system, almost. It relies on that. And the reason why it relies on emergencies is that it depends very much on credit creation or debt, whichever way you want to look at it. But mm-hmm. it relies on the creation of enormous amounts of out of nothing. It's ultimately mouse clicked, as they say, cash that is created out of nowhere on computer screens in banks and especially central banks, the lenders and buyers of last resort. And it's pumped into the hyper-financialized system. But in order for this mechanism to happen, the system requires a kind of rationale. It requires reasons to do it. And the reasons are, as I said, an endless series of events that are can be described as emergencies. And I think we've seen a few already over the last 4 years, and there really hasn't been a break. Now we are existentially almost within this paradoxical situation where in order for the system to continue to survive its own crisis, it needs these external emergencies. So emergencies that need to be experienced as some kind of potentially eschatological, cataclysmic, apocalyptic events, which provide alibis for the system to do what it's doing.
Wow.
So I used to call it tapeworm capitalism. So you may not know, John, how a tapeworm works in your body. The way a tapeworm works in your body is it injects a chemical into your system that makes you crave what's good for the tapeworm.
Right. A fundamental part of parasites is deception, like as you just described. Right.
Right. So I used to say the injection was the media, but in fact, this guy is nailing a better explanation of the injection. The injection is a theater-constructed emergency, you know, that adrenalizes and grabs attention while, you know, once again, the tapeworm parasites some more.
Yes.
Right.
Right. Right.
Right. And my objection to the WHO treaty is it's the most elegant machinery I've ever seen to grab assets after the injection. Oh, you know, John, you have a pathogen in your septic tank, so we have to come in and quarantine your neighborhood and move you all out and take everything and shut down all the businesses and all the income, and then we'll buy your real estate from you for 10 cents on the dollar, you know, when it's all over, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you can absolutely finish off the globe. You can finish off all independent income and grab all real estate for 10 cents on the dollar, if not zero. So...
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's astonishing. Yeah.
I quarantine your neighborhood because you're full of pathogens. And when I pick up the fee title for all the land, then I will appropriate huge amounts of government money to fix the neighborhood, you know, now that I own it.
Yeah. Now that I own it, right. We're going to fix it up. Get rid of those germs. You know?
Yes. There you go.
Doing you a big favor here, bud. So.
Right. Okay.
I didn't hear you say thank you.
Oh, okay. But you get their kids to come do a photo op with you for saving the neighborhood.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay, let's turn to Fed Watch. Actually, that clip of Vigi, Professor Vigi, who I think he's a professor at University of Cardiff in Wales. I wouldn't swear to that, but anyway, he's a Western professor. Excellent summary. But let's keep it going with Boeing. Boeing is back in the news with another home video shot from the seats. I'm not going to play the whole thing, but it's another Boeing 737 just ripping apart during takeoff. Let's watch a few seconds. Horrifying. Looks like they've come back. Look at that. Yeah, that's confidence inspiring. Oh, you believe that?
I checked my flight back to Amsterdam in May. I'm flying Boeing.
I think twice about that one. So let's get into a story, though, about what's going on at Boeing. This is the best story I've found so far because it resonates with my own experience and resonates with the people I've met and it just describes what's going on. This is very believable. City Journal, it's an empty executive suite, and it's noticed that it's an insider explains. Speaking with a Boeing insider who has direct knowledge of the company's leadership decisions, the story begins in 2018 with the first 737 MAX crash. And at that point, what happens is the board implements a sweeping set of changes that cause a huge turnover in talent. So that now, today, the executive council running the company is all outsiders. The current CEO is a General Electric guy. That's bad news. A financialized company, had made a light bulb in 40 years, as is the CFO, whom he brought in. So General Electric guys at the top, bad sign. The headquarters in Arlington is empty. Not because it says nobody lives there. It's not that nobody lives in the building. It's nobody lives in Arlington. The CEO lives in New Hampshire. The CFO lives in Connecticut. The head of HR, Orlando. We just instituted a policy that everyone has to come into work 5 days a week, except the executives, who use private jets to travel to meetings. And that's the story. It's a company under caretakers. It is not under owners. And it is not under people who love airplanes. The workforce knows if you love things you're building or if it's just another set of assets to you. At some point, the insider says, you cannot recover with process what you have lost with love. That's Boeing. They're not getting out of the news anytime soon.
That is as good an explanation of I've ever seen of the Paul O'Neill problem.
Yep. That's perfect. These people are mailing it in. They don't care. They care about one thing, and that's their quarterly compensation based on stock. That's all they care about.
So I told you after the pandemic, we had to throw 80 companies out of the screen, and that's what you saw again. The engineers were booted out. The MBAs come in. The thing is financialized, and nobody at the top cares anything about, you know, what's really going on. And they don't love the business. They don't care about the business. It's just a cash flow.
Yep.
Right.
And the workers know it.
Right.
People working in the company, they know the score. You think you're so clever and hiding from them, they know what you're up to.
Well, but let me say it another way. If you are pilots flying what used to be the top safety record airline in the world, and your CEO and board just mandated that you be given gene therapy that changes your DNA, that increases the chance of blood clotting and accidents.
And cancer.
And cancer. So your employees know you're trying to kill them? The smart ones.
Yeah, right.
What do you think that does to a culture?
I don't know, planes flying apart on the runway?
Maybe.
I mean, you just saw it. Right. It's terrible.
Right, but understand that the idea we're going to have a land war when our number one plane company can't get the Secretary of State to Brussels because the plane breaks down.
And your fighter jets need the runway to be swept clear of all debris to take off.
Okay. So
it's your number one fighter jet.
So, you know, when Karl Rove presumably said, you know, we make our own reality now. Yeah. If the people who make our own reality left the people who know how to make reality behind, then the new reality.
Right. So twisted. That's why we have to laugh.
How long can the new media, you know, how long can the media look at the layoffs? I mean, the corporate media is laying off everybody. So that's their reality creation machine.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Apparently we are betting the ranch on biodefense and mind control because,
you
know,
all you got.
Right. The sane are watching this and thinking, how is this supposed to work? So the reality manufacturing machinery is, I mean, it can bring down the Francis Scott Key Bridge or do some of the things we're going to talk about today. So, yeah, it can destroy the infrastructure, it can still do covert operations. The covert operations talent seems to be, humming along. Right.
Sure can. Let's cut to the second most astonishing chart of the week for my money, and that's a chart of Boeing since the going direct reset. Look at this. So the S&P is up 77%. since August 2019, Boeing down 47%. Unbelievable.
Right. And in the middle, ITA is the aerospace and defense ETF.
Yep.
So it's up 22%, and that includes, you know, Boeing being part of it.
Okay.
So the defense industry is up, and the aerospace industry is up 22%. The S&P up 76%. Yep. Boeing in the doghouse, and that's.
And this is probably being dragged down by this.
Right.
Okay, I want to show you something. This here, okay, that's the Fed printing $5 trillion,
okay? Right.
And using it to buy assets from non-banks, which added in deposit money another $5 trillion, okay? With all that sea of money, $10 trillion, Boeing declined by 50%. I mean, that's awful.
Look at the rise. Look at that second, you know, it dips down and then that second rise. That is a tsunami of fiscal stimulus.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, we don't have the same clear numbers as we did on the 5+5. But right now you are experiencing a tsunami of fiscal stimulus.
Yeah.
You know, so we have a tsunami of monetary stimulus, a tsunami of fiscal stimulus. You know, God knows what the world would look like if you didn't have that. It would probably have to look like what Russia has done. Because Russia has not enjoyed that. Russia has been forced to live in a world of real economics.
Yes. They have.
Right.
Right.
And now they have more muscle because of it.
Right. But they're 35 years into that now.
Right.
30, 33, whatever.
Right. Right.
They're over a generation into it.
Right.
And this is an army that's faced peer adversaries for a long time and prevailed. When was the last time the U.S. faced a peer adversary? You could beat goat herders with sandals. You're humiliated.
Right.
You know. Good luck. No.
Well, the goal is not to win. The goal is to spend lots and lots of money.
they're doing well on that. But the Boeing stock, if you lose the half in that environment, how long are you for this world? Honestly.
Let me
ask you this. Do you think Boeing has another year left?
I don't know. I honestly don't know.
A lot
of it comes down because a lot of their purchases and, you know, a lot of their purchases are politically engineered at this point, is what I'm presuming. But here's the thing. You know, in theory, we know how to turn around a company like Boeing. But where is the commitment top down to do that?
You got me. That's why I ask. I don't know.
You know, can the insane gather
their... I don't see a good answer for Boeing.
I don't see a good answer either, because I know what it takes to turn the company around, and it's not clear to me that the insane have the philosophy or commitment to do it.
I don't know.
Right. But that question, the Boeing question, is an extreme example of what's going on in every state house and every county in the country.
In what way?
So we have been promoting people and putting them in positions for a variety of criteria that has nothing to do with performance or fundamental economics.
Right.
And it's complex. It's not simple. But the reality is, when you run an organization for anything other than ruthless attention to economics and performance, what you get is something that is not economic and doesn't perform. And that's what you're seeing all over the country.
Yep. Yep. Totally agree. Okay, let's keep it going with FedWatch and turn to Tennessee. This is a bad picture. This is a grim picture. I'm about to show you. This is not good. Tennessee Star, Americans skipping meals to afford housing under Biden. Now, they blame Biden, but you could cross that out and say under... You know, the monetary stimulus.
The Fed.
under the going direct reset. Okay.
Right. Right.
Because this was good. This started under Trump. No doubt about that. That
right.
$5 trillion ramp, that was 2020.
Right.
Trump was in office
right.
then. Okay. All right. So they're blaming it on Biden. Okay. Fair enough. But let's just look at what's going on. Renters and homeowners are significantly reducing their quality of life to afford housing. Yeah, okay. Nearly one in five homeowners and renters reported skipping meals to afford housing. Here we go. We're coming down where the meat get to the bone here. Americans made other sacrifices to stay in their homes. One-fifth of them reporting working more hours. Another fifth saying they have sold their belongings. And more than one in six having dipped into retirement savings. And 15.6% reporting they're putting off medical care to afford housing payments. So the economy's reached a point where people are making hard choices. Real hard.
Right. And let me also point out that during the pandemic, small landlords were basically targeted and destroyed. A lot of them wiped out. And you had big institutional money coming up and building or picking up multifamily apartment, you know, or residential, you know, from homeowners. So you had a shift in real estate steadily because of the arbitrage and cost of capital advantaging the big guys and the pandemic policies of moving real estate out of ownership by a local landlord to, you know, BlackRock, Blackstone, and the big players.
Right.
And that is part of this. It's not just the, you know, it's not just all the monetary stimulus. There has been a real engineering of the housing supply into institutional hands, which have been very aggressive at raising rents.
So, yes.
Right.
Yes, very aggressive. Right. And rents have gone up far in excess of incomes.
I'm sure, you know, Larry Fink would look at that article and say, oh, great, plan is working.
Yeah.
Right.
Because there's going to have to be more stimulus. You're going to end up with more money printing, no doubt about that. And so, I would not hold your breath waiting for the Fed to cut interest rates. I don't think that's coming.
No. So, well, but I mean, look at if you're the central bankers, if you're Jay Powell and you're Janet Yellen and, you know, who's at Treasury, but, you know, central banker, and
yes,
you're Larry Fink, you're looking at this article and thinking Joe's doing a great job because he's the chew toy, right?
Right.
He's
Tennessee the chew stars toy. They're blaming Biden for all this.
Right.
You know, right.
It's working.
It's working perfectly.
Yeah, there you go.
Know, because that publication successfully hid the true cause of this.
Right.
Which is, you know, the debt-based money and the willy-nilly printing. Yep.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, it's 20 years if we pay 17% on our credit cards and they pay 0%. I mean, that has, you know, year after year after year, where do you think this is going to go?
It's you pay 17%, but we lend it to you.
Right. But we access the money we do that with from your pension funds.
we gin it
well,
up.
Well, we print it out of thin.
From your constitutional right to issue your own money. But we don't issue money. We issue debt. How about that? How do you like that?
So, you know, the Fed just relieved the reserve requirements on treasuries. So now basically the banks can, you know, can arbitrage the treasury yield curve. So, you know, they can get deposits at one rate and put it out in treasuries at another rate and just balloon their balance sheets.
It's just what they needed was another sop, another bailout.
Right.
Exactly what the banks needed. It's what the economy needs. More bankers.
Well, great. But they just, yeah. Well, I think more bankers is good if they're making local loans that are productive. So,
except they're not doing that. That's not what banking is these days.
Well, but
banking
but
used to be you come in, I'll loan you money for collateral, I'll loan you money against your business proposition. That's not what it is now. It's what Fabio said. It's I'll gin up the money out of loan based on your fantasy scapegoat.
Well, but if you talk to a local banker, the local bankers are trying to do productive, and the extent to which they're not, it's because the Fed is pushing them to put the money in the investment portfolio to balloon to carry the Treasury that's putting out the massive fiscal stimulus that we just talked about when that's that line up. Right.
So we can flush your branch down the drain when the time comes.
Well, John, somebody has to support Boeing, right?
Yeah, somebody does. You're right. Somebody does. Should be an undertaker, but nevertheless. let's turn to a story from, this is from my U.S. Times, and it's our American progressives making themselves sad. But it's way down on the sanitized version here. Okay, so there's the graphic. Are American progressives making themselves sad? This is like, well, we'll talk about it. America has slipped down the global happiness rankings. Gallup reported in mid-March that America has dropped out of the top 20 for the first time since it started taking its survey in 2012. In a year, the U.S. has fallen from 15th place to 23rd. There's a difference among groups demographically. Some groups tend to lag behind others in the pursuit of happiness. Liberals are sadder than conservatives. Liberals are also far more likely than conservatives to report having been diagnosed with mental illness. And then there's age groups. Happiness fell for every age group, but the most precipitously for those 30 and younger. Older Americans ranked 10th globally in happiness, whereas younger Americans ranked 62nd. Wow, that's a big difference. But what do you make of that?
So to me, it's really scary because I think younger people are looking at the lawlessness and looking at all the games and lies, and they don't understand the details. They don't begin to understand the sort of mechanisms and lies as well as you do, John. But they know that they're dealing with a lawless and rigged system. And I heard one young person the other day was quoted to me by their mother say the only way to get ahead is to steal.
That's not an irrational conclusion.
It's not an irrational conclusion, but what it means is society deteriorates and it makes it harder for everybody to build wealth the more we adopt that kind of mentality. So the other thing I will say, because I go back and forth between lots of different groups, conservatives absolutely have it beaten into them. You are responsible. The environment is whatever it is, and you are responsible, and you can be productive no matter what in any environment. And no, there are no excuses, because that's not how life works. Life is difficult. Right. So one of my favorite books is The Road Less Traveled by Scott Peck, and he starts out, you know, life is difficult. This is a great truth. But I think when you believe that you are responsible for the result, no matter what, you know, it puts you in a position to take action in a way that gets you out of getting depressed or getting sad about what's going on. You're too busy taking action. Right.
Right. I remember going to a psychiatrist way, way, way back, and just kind of felt like after a few weeks, I'm in a hamster wheel here. And I just took matters in my own hands and just stopped going, stopped my medication, and started going to the gym. And within weeks, it felt immeasurably better. Because I took matters into my own hands.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, I'm not relying on you, lady, to make me feel better. It's not working.
What is it that I control, and what is it that I can take action to do within the, you know, the parameters that I control?
Yeah.
I mean, here's the bad news. We're in the middle of a war. Right now, it's primarily covert. It could get overt. That's it. You know, I don't like it, but it is what it is.
Yeah, exactly. You can only take care of your side of the street and only take care of things that are under your control, and can't let the things over which you have no control get to you. Just can't.
Well, but here's the thing. If you look at my time, a portion of my time is dedicated to helping change the things that I don't control. Right. I can take action to help contribute, and we all should. So I told you this story before. There was a moment when I was taking first year Bible. I had this wonderful Washington paralegal who was helping the co-pastor. And she asked me about the Saleri model and sort of my model of my economic philosophy. And I explained it to her. And she looked at me and she said, "You're making it much too complicated. It's in Leviticus. We have to take care of ourselves. We have to take care of the land, and we have to take care of each other. That's it."
Wow.
Right. Simple.
There's other things in Leviticus I'm not sure I'd be too comfortable with, but
I agree. But that one was
point is well taken.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Let's turn to our last story, which is actually a video in FedWatch, which just as easily could have gone in "Hey Robot" due to like the digitization of money, and it's this story. Let me just roll this clip and we'll talk about it.
It's being called one of the largest cash heists in LA history.
Sure is. Let's go out to Gigi Graciette in Sylmar, where burglars broke into the vault of a money storage facility. They got away with a lot of money, Gigi.
And as you said, Brooke, this seems like something out of a movie, a Mission Impossible movie. Take a look at the video. This all happening here in Sylmar on Easter Sunday. An estimated $30 million stolen in cash from a Sylmar money storage facility. The burglars reportedly breaking in either through the side of the building or the roof and then managing to open up a vault where the cash was being stored without triggering any of the sophisticated alarms. And the burglary crew was so stealth and meticulous that no one noticed the money was gone until Monday when employees opened up the vault, which showed no obvious signs of a break-in. Now, the company is Garda World. They have branches around the world and over 132,000 employees. And they specialize in cash services, which includes ATM services and armored truck transports. According to their website, some of their clients are Fortune 500 companies, even the United States federal government.
Wow. Okay. So you heard her say it's like it's out of a movie, because it is out of a movie. That story is ridiculous. It's completely fictional.
So I just talked to somebody in another country to go unnamed who said that the businesses like this in their country have been slowly enervated down to one which is about to go bankrupt. And they see this as part of the engineering to a 100% digital system.
Yeah. That's
so that's going on in another country. And a major country, an important country, and now suddenly this is happening. And so I think ridiculous is a very accurate term.
Well, let's just talk about it for a minute.
Okay.
I mean, they don't know whether they went through the roof, through the ceiling, or through the wall. Number one, this wizard like group, these magicians, don't trigger any alarms. There's no mention of, well, maybe it was an inside job. But the thing to me is, like, it was $30 million. Even if all that money is $100 bills, that weighs 660 pounds. Your security cameras don't have anybody on footage, on tape, doing this?
But John, haven't you read Harry Potter? Haven't you watched the Harry Potter movies?
Right.
Surely exactly. The wizards can do this, right?
Right.
This is very Harry Potter-like. But, you know, so the story is completely ridiculous. But I think no matter what the explanation was, whether it was an inside job or whether it's just more theater and made up, I mean, think about it. If you went to the CEO and said, look, you know, the insurance companies will give you $30 million if you play along with this theater story, would you do it?
I mean, I wouldn't, but
you wouldn't, but
well
would
taken.
The CEO of 130,000
member company, employee company, which is half the size of JP Morgan, you're damn right they would. You don't get to that level in modern corporate America, modern big business corporate America. You don't get to that level, essentially, unless you're a criminal.
Right.
It's,
so they're
very hard.
You know, they're playing ball in the going out of business plan. So I don't know. So whatever the truth of the story, all options, what they say is the leadership is engineering an end of cash. Don't let them. That's the message. Don't let them. Right.
Yes, cash is dangerous. And again, I go back to the very beginning of the pandemic where I was driving because I wasn't going to fly with a mask on. I drove a lot on the interstates. These signs like, use your credit card because cash is dirty. It's got germs. It's like, oh, boy.
There we are.
Oh,
there's
boy.
Those germs
here,
again.
Here we go. Okay, let's turn to space military global turf wars. What is this first story? Oh, yeah. Okay, this is interesting. And we got a map to go with this one, too. This is from the UK. Government has no national plan for the defense of the UK in a war, despite renewed threats of conflict. This is kind of straightforward. The government has no national plan for the defense of the UK or mobilization of its people and industry in a war, despite renewed threats of conflict, Sky News has learned, with ministers warning that Britain is moving to a pre-war world amid mounting concerns about Russia, China, and Iran, it can be revealed that officials have started to develop a cross-government national defense plan. According to interviews with multiple defense sources, former senior officers, and academics, such a move would need a lot more investment in defense and much better communication with the public about the need for everyone to play their part in strengthening UK resilience and deterring aggression. So they're getting people ready for war, no doubt about that.
So whenever I'm trying to figure out if something's just theater or it's real, you know, I start looking for what's going on and planning on the ground.
Yeah.
You know, so what is the military doing in communities? What are they doing? You know, and you get little signals that this is starting to get real because there's talk of draft in multiple countries.
Right.
But the other thing you see is we now see state legislatures saying you can't call up our National Guard unless Congress declares war. Because what is going on is, you know, is sneaky call-ups, is covert call-ups, covert right. uses. And the state legislators are starting to say, no, you can't do that.
Right.
So
and that's good.
That's very good. Very yeah. good.
Yeah. Along those lines of getting on our pre-war footing, let's cut to a map from status to and this is where NATO has an enhanced forward presence. This is the eastern kind of flank of the NATO, and they've got each you see these countries that so that's not Britain. So that's Estonia. So this country here that's Estonia,
right.
but its coordinating state is UK. Okay?
Right.
So the light blue is a coordinating state. I'm not really sure what that means, but I got it. It's sort of the power.
So I'm assuming you've got UK because they're moving soldiers into
yes.
these various NATO countries.
Yeah.
And
so here are all the pairings. It's Latvia and Canada, Lithuania, Germany, Poland, U.S., Slovakia, and Czech Republic. It's very organized. Hungary's
right.
on its own for whatever reason. Romania, France, Bulgaria, and Italy.
Right, and you have the big new base going into Romania. So
yeah.
essentially they're trying to surround and move all the troops in. And you know, this is what's known as a buildup.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right. Because Ukraine has gone so well, we want to expand the front.
So here's the it's very important. Look up NATO in Article 5. If Russia attacks or anybody attacks a NATO country, an Article 5 can be triggered and NATO goes to war. Because one is attacked, then all are responsible to respond. So, you know, the fight over whether or not the Ukraine can come into NATO is because nobody wants an Article 5 triggered.
Well, even if they did, I don't think Article 5 would be triggered if memory serves. You can't just name... You can't just say, "Oh, you're NATO. Oh, you attacked us. We're gonna get." I don't think it works that way. That's my.
Well,
but it's been a while since I've reviewed Article 5.
If you look at what they triggered in Article 5 on 9/11, so
yeah,
all you need
remember.
Is one terrorist act to trigger an Article 5.
Okay.
So
a pack of lies.
Of course, it's a pack of lies. The uh-huh. whole thing is a pack of lies. But if you move
the attack
enough,
on Ukraine, you know, the Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the special military operation, that's been going on for 2 years.
Right.
And at this point, I don't think you can name the pettifoggery of naming Ukraine a NATO nation and using that as a something to fly.
Right. And you can't let Ukraine into NATO because you're not supposed to allow into NATO a country that is at war.
Is okay. at war. Right.
And you can't move a country that's at war in and trigger
right.
an Article 5. But what
right.
you can do is you can engineer another terrorist action, blame it on the Russians, and trigger an Article 5 when you have enough troops in place. I'm not saying that you would do that, but
right.
these guys would do that.
Yeah, absolutely. They would. Yes.
They did it on 9/11.
Right. That's absolutely they would do that.
Right.
Yep. Okay, let's go back to lawlessness on the world stage with this story. Mexico, this is on the heels of Israel bombing Syria's embassy. Mexico suspends ties with Ecuador after police raid embassy. Mexico has suspended diplomatic relations with Ecuador after police forcibly broke into its embassy and arrested former Ecuadorian Vice President Jorge Glass, who had sought political asylum there. Alicia Bárcena, Mexico's foreign minister, said that a number of diplomats suffered injuries during the incident, which she called a violation of the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations. Mexican diplomatic personnel will immediately leave Ecuador, adding Mexico will appeal to the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, to hold Ecuador accountable for violations of international law. So it's begun. The gloves are coming off on the world stage.
Okay, well, you rip through diplomatic immunity, and we're in for, you know, but between Yellen saying she's going to grab assets illegally. And diplomatic immunity melting down. You know, it's the gloves are off. So
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. They are. This is a dangerous time. And Ecuador is trying to pitch this as a violation of its sovereignty. Incredibly. It's like, no, the embassy is that's what an embassy is. It's sovereign territory, like an island within another country.
So you can run a planet by law or you can run it by force. And right. The reality is if there's no law and you run it by force, then the entire global economy has to unravel.
Yes.
Right.
Right. The entire global economy has to unravel.
Right.
That's a mouthful.
So what Ecuador and Yellen and here's the question. Did Ecuador do it or did the CIA force Ecuador to do it?
I would have to say the aroma of gaslighting coming off of that story, like you violating our sovereignty, leaves, there's no question in my mind that the CIA or the U.S. are behind that. None.
Yeah, see, if I had time, I'd do a deep dive on who owns Ecuador's debt.
Yeah.
And then we'd know. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Okay, let's turn to Hey Robot. I cannot wait to get your take on this next story. It's not even a story, it's a Wikipedia entry, but there's a story in the Wikipedia entry.
So I've been trying to figure this one out.
Change healthcare. Okay, let's just scroll down to the money shot here. Okay, but you need to know, this is an important piece, I think. Change healthcare. In January 2021, United Health Group's Optum Insight unit agreed to acquire Change Healthcare. United Healthcare is one of the two companies, along with Cardinal Industries or Cardinal Healthcare, that was involved in insider trading the day Obamacare, the day the surprise Obamacare decision came out 10 minutes late after someone had backed a truck up to both of those companies in the stock market. So that's a tell. But there's a 2024 cyber attack. On February 21 of this year, Change Healthcare was hit by a cyber attack, which prevented payouts to doctors on the platform. As a result, payments and medical claims could not be processed by United Healthcare Group, leading to widespread disruption. Patients were forced to pay many of their medications out of pocket. Many healthcare providers said they lost significant revenue as a result of this disruption every day, up to $100 million a day. A day later, on February 22nd, United Health Group filed a notice to the SEC stating that a suspected, here we go, a suspected nation-state associated cybersecurity threat actor gained access to healthcare's information technology system. So right there, the people who got screwed out of this, they're going to blame it on Russia. Okay? So a week later, February 29, United Health Group confirmed that the ransomware attack was perpetrated by a cybercrime threat actor who represented itself to the company as Alf Black Cat. And then on March 4th, Reuters reported that a Bitcoin payment equivalent to nearly $22 million U.S. was made to the cryptocurrency Wallis associated with ALF, and on this yarn goes. What's up?
So the $22 million payment was made, but they never got this stuff back. And to this day, my understanding is they can't make payments. Now, let's just stop, because I've been trying to figure out what's going on here.
Right.
So number one, apparently this operation processes $2 trillion of U.S. healthcare payments a year. Let me sink in it. $2 trillion of both. Right. It's primarily government, Medicare, and presumably Medicaid maybe. But it's presumably mostly government, but it's private insurance too. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, that... apparently, they have records for one third of the healthcare records in this country. Now, can you explain to me why the federal government would allow its operation to be so centralized digitally so that $2 trillion went through one company? That's extraordinary dependency. So, okay, so that's number one. And why you would centralize it in this way, you know, this gets back to total control.
Yes.
You know, you would centralize it so you can implement social credit systems and total control and get access to that data for the database for a variety of reasons, none of which are good. Okay? So we're talking about a system that was designed to have no privacy in the first place, which is one of the reasons some people I know, like you and me, don't go to doctors.
Right.
We don't want them having our data. Okay. So that's number one. But number two, my understanding, because I found out about this not from reading about it or hearing about it, which shocked me, you know, because my ears are pretty much to the ground. I heard about it from a doctor who hasn't got reimbursed for months. So basically, you know, you've got a doctor's office that's now lagging 2 months of reimbursements.
Right. And you saw it was $100 million a day. Now, do the math.
Well, it's doctor's offices and hospitals. Now, what I'm told is that Medicare is now estimating how much, you know, if a doctor's office got $20,000 a month last year, they're going to start paying $20,000 a month in advance until the system can get fixed and caught up. God knows how long that would take. But the reality is you're talking about something that, I mean, I cannot begin to describe all the nefarious things you could use that data for, number one. But number two, how many doctor's offices and healthcare providers and hospitals you can put out of business with this.
Right. And put out of business selectively.
Right. Right.
Right.
Right. So we're back to the same question we asked with Francis Scott Key. Is the sabotage internal or external? There's no way to know.
No way to know.
Right.
Way to know.
Whatever the truth is, it's not good. And if there's any reason you want to build your life around decentralized, resilient living and institutions, here it is.
Yes.
Right.
Right. There you go. They can pick you off anytime they want. In an atmosphere of crime that never goes, it never gets punished, and no rule of law, I mean, it's open season on honest people.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah, but being honest is a great way to live.
Right. Right. Yeah. You sleep at night. Yeah.
Yeah, but you gotta make sure you're only associating with honest people.
Yeah.
Right.
True that. Okay, yeah. Let's keep it going with the most hilarious story from my money of the week. This is from Hindustan
I
Times.
Love this story. When I saw this story, I said, John is going to love this story.
This is insane. Okay, so 1,000 Indians, part of Amazon's generative AI driven Just Walk Out project in Fresh Stores report. What was billed as a self-checkout system powered by cameras and sensors, giving the illusion of an automated system, turned out to be a little different, okay? So Amazon's phasing out its Just Walk Out tech from all of its Fresh grocery stores. Why? Because they were saying it was billed as a self-checkout system powered by cameras and sensors, so it seemed like it was automated. And Amazon came out and said, here's what we're doing. It's a combination of computer vision, object recognition, sensors, AI, all that good stuff. Turns out, though, not all of the stores had it. What was really going on was the system, it relied on more than 1,000 people in India watching and labeling videos to ensure accurate checkouts. The bottom line is that cashiers were simply moved off-site. They were moved to India, and they were watching from India, and they watched as you shopped. No AI, no sensors about it. You're just being watched from Bhopal. What a huge lie Amazon tells on that.
Well, but this you keep running into this with AI. It's not economic, and it depends on thousands of people fixing the mess. Right. You know, and what the AI lovers will tell you is, oh, we're just working it out. We're working it out. We're working it out. But I it's really funny because you now have these little Amazon Fresh places in airports, and I'll come through and I'll literally walk around to avoid them because they have the most creepy feeling. So I can't explain it, but it's just like, ooh, creepy. And it wouldn't surprise me if part of that creepy family, you know, feeling came from the fact you got all these poor folks in India just watching us.
It's creepy. So
I live for many, many years under 24/7 surveillance. And, you know, and it was great training for now what, you know, because now we're all living under 24/7 surveillance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. Exactly. We are.
Welcome to my world.
Let's continue the theme of the of AI not being all it's cracked up to be with another story that seems vaguely familiar. AI could add 1 million tons to copper demand by 2030, says an industry expert there. Data centers. So the data centers are needed for all this processing power for AI. The energy transition, which includes electric vehicles and renewable energy technologies, is expected to fuel a surge in copper consumption over the coming years as the world moves toward eliminating carbon emissions. So AI is just doing all this. And China, by the way, is the world's largest producer and consumer of copper. So AI, it's supposed to be this miracle thing, but it's adding all this copper. So we're reducing emissions on one hand, but we're increasing emissions on the other hand as we need to harvest, you know, 1 million tons more or whatever of copper.
I told you, I wrote a book review of Atlas of AI, which describes the extraordinary environmental damage of AI. And if you look at what you need for a control grid of what they're building,
yeah,
the environmental expense is extraordinary because you're trying to replace markets which just work, you know, magically with very little energy. You're trying to replace them with massive top-down intelligence and control that requires this huge infrastructure. It's so wasteful. And the, you know, the perfect example is Bitcoin requires more energy than Switzerland. There you go.
Bitcoin is another example, and electric cars are supposed to be fuel efficient. But you're hiding the dirt upstream. So all you're doing is you're transferring finite resources in a constant amount from one group to another group. That's it. That's your technology. It's just a wealth transfer.
Well, it's a wealth transfer that comes at extraordinary, you know, it's so damaging economically and environmentally because the waste embedded in it, you need government and huge government subsidies to make it look like it's, you know, to make it go. And so you're talking about spending, it's like when you read pharma food, you're talking about spending $17 to make a hamburger.
But you know what you get in all three cases? You get a lot more surveillance capability, a lot more surveillance bandwidth with AI, with electric cars, and with Bitcoin, all three. You got a trifecta there.
What you get is you get to cancel all the legislatures and implement fiscal policy with a digital control mechanism and digital dollars.
Yeah.
So you get the central bankers to be able to control governance top to bottom from the monetary side. That's what you get. And forget democracy, forget republics, forget all the political process, forget legislators, forget shared intelligence, forget markets. The central bankers can just dictate a top down.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Right.
Yep.
Have you seen our cartoon this week?
I did, but it slipped. I just filed it away.
It's Karsten's. Wait a minute. Let me just read it to you. It's so funny. In the first panel, he says, of course we believe in freedom. And then he smiles. And in the third column, he says, to control absolutely every aspect of your life.
Right. Right.
Right. Yep.
That's our notion of freedom. Speaking of surveillance and control, let's go to the next story. This is straight from the TSA. Acceptable identification at the TSA checkpoint. So here, let me punch in a little bit on this. Here we go. Here's the punchline. Beginning May 7th, 2025. If you plan to use your state-issued ID or license to fly within the U.S., make sure it is it's real ID compliant. So for the time being, you can get away with a U.S. passport or U.S. passport card for the time being.
For the time being. And that real ID system is networked globally. So.
Yeah. Okay. So that's it for Hey Robot. A bunch of entries this week in Hey Robot. The control grid is coming, and it's coming in a major way. These technologies, they don't make any sense unless it's to advance the control grid.
I will say, to the extent you get state and local government and citizens waking up, the consumer can do a huge amount to shift this. The consumer can reject this. You know, I walked in at very late at night to Kroger on the way back to Hickory Valley, And I went to the, there were no lines to check out. It was just self-checkout. And I went and it had a big sign saying, no cash. So I called the attendant after I bagged everything and said, well, do you want to put it back or do you want my cash? So they figured out how they could take cash.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, they did.
Imagine that.
They did. Yeah.
Imagine that. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Let's turn to Farmageddon now. And this first story is really a chart from Jessica Hockett, who has done a lot of good work, good forensic of work, in figuring out how the pandemic narrative was sold and ginned up at the very front end of the pandemic. And she's got a couple charts here that are worth talking about. Cook County, Chicago versus New York City. What's important here is not Chicago, it's New York, okay? And New York is in red here. So let's look at this. It's weekly deaths at home. That's what she's talking about. And this, by the way, here, this is the very front end. This is like March 15th. This is the front end of 15. You see that 15 days to slow the spread. The announcement's right there. And this is a month later. So it's weekly. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks, basically, there. Home deaths just skyrocket in New York. And they're basically flat in Chicago. And remember, New York was the epicenter for the pandemic narrative, the bodies outside the hospitals, dead bodies here. It's the media center of the world. New York played a fundamental role, and there are dead bodies piling up left and right at home. Very interesting. What's the cause of death, you might say? What could cause that in New York but not Chicago? Well, you're not going to find out because we go to our next chart and we see New York City, weekly resident deaths at home versus home deaths autopsied. So here's the spike we just saw. Deaths through the roof. And at the same time, your long-term average of autopsies plunges through the floor. Exactly at the same time, there's a spike in deaths. How very interesting. If I didn't know any better, I would say that a lot of people were murdered to prop up a pandemic story. And moreover, those murders were then covered up and promptly put into the COVID bucket. And no one is ever the wiser because there were no autopsies.
So from everything I heard from New York during that period, I assumed that was what was happening. Deaths were being engineered to make a story about the pandemic. And if you got reports from the ground from what was really happening versus what was being said in the press, again, you had this huge, you know, let's manufacture reality thing going on. But my guess is if we could get to the bottom of what really happened, it is easily possible to prosecute Andrew Cuomo for genocide. Remember, the health agency that contributed to this, the state health agency, is the one that Bobby Ann Cox is trying to stop from being able to do quarantine camps where they can basically grab people with no warrant, grab their property with no warrant, and put them under quarantine with no due process forever.
Yeah.
Which, well, I control, I call the, you know, sort of the U.S. financial control system through health.
I want to be clear about something. I don't think those deaths were engineered. I think those deaths are very, very real. And the reason I think they're real is that if they were engineered, you wouldn't have needed a dip in the autopsies. You could have kept the autopsies the same. Those deaths
were
real.
When I said engineer, I meant they were killed.
Yeah, they were killed.
Right. So I didn't mean, when I said engineer, I didn't mean that they were made up.
Right. To be clear, that's what happened.
People were murdered.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, those two charts, or just kind of spend some time looking at those and ask yourself what went on there. What other explanation is there? And there are not many answers.
So I'm going to say something really hard because I dealt with Andrew Cuomo a lot when I worked in Washington. You know, Andrew Cuomo was the secretary of HUD that, you know, was contributed to the targeting of the honest government officials in Hamilton Securities.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I used to say to people, if you allow Andrew Cuomo to be attorney general or you allow, you know, Andrew Cuomo to be governor, I mean, Andrew Cuomo is the kind of person who would kill hundreds of thousands of people to get ahead.
Yeah.
Right? That's, you know, this is what, you know, I go back to my old mantra, crime that pays is crime that stays. when you allow criminals to be your governor, this is what you're going to get.
Right.
So it wasn't just Andrew Cuomo who murdered these people. It was a whole machinery. And the people in New York allowed this. And the people on Wall Street financed it.
Big time.
Andrew Cuomo would never have been attorney general and would never have been governor if the people on Wall Street hadn't engineered that.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's your financial system.
You got it. You got it. Okay. Let's keep it going on Farmageddon. This next one you can file in the stop me when this sounds familiar bucket. The largest fresh egg producer in the U.S. has found bird flu in chickens at Texas and Michigan plants. Oh, joy. The largest producer of fresh eggs in the U.S. said Tuesday it had temporarily halted production at a Texas plant after bird flu was found in chickens. The company, by the way, is Mississippi-based Calmaine Foods. And it's a bunch of, it's approximately 1.6 million hens and 337,000 pullets, which is 4%, 3.5% of its total flock. But here's where it starts to get like, well, what's going on? The announcement comes a day after state health officials said a person had been diagnosed with bird flu after being in contact with cows presumed to be infected, and that the risk to the public remains low. So somehow the bird flu jumps species into a person, which, by the way, the human case in Texas, that's the first known instance globally of a person catching this version of a bird flu from a mammal, federal health officials said. That's just like the COVID story. Jump from a bat to a human. How about that? Dairy cows, and now it's spreading all over the place. You got dairy cows in Texas and Kansas and Michigan, and it's just going crazy, so get ready.
The cattle are the last source of independent income to the independent farmers and producers. So the war on independent farm income is on, and it's all part of controlling the food system, which is all part of control. You know, if you want to go to an all digital financial system that implements total control, you got to control the food system. Here it is.
Yep,
if you think I believe those tests, you're you know, right.
Right. It's another yarn being spun. You know,
this is Patsy capitalism.
The Patsy has jumped species, just like it did last time, just on the very last episode of Patsy capitalism. The thing jumps from one species to another.
I wonder if that virus was involved in the theft of the cash, because the virus could get in the building and into the thing and get the money out, you know,
it's
on
invisible.
Its own. Right.
It's invisible and it's strong. It can kill you. it can muscle out 660 pounds of cash. Without ever showing up on the camera at all. How about that?
So imagine tomorrow if we woke up in America and Europe and suddenly our Patsy gene disappeared and we stopped being the Patsy. Wouldn't that be amazing?
That would be awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Last story
in Farmageddon. This is a chart. I'm not sure I believe it. Visualizing the size of the global senior population, and they divide it basically by continent. And you can see North America and Europe there going from 113 million in 1980 to 208 million. That's not much of an increase. It's not even 50%. Everywhere else, though, it's 3 to 4 times. Asia goes from 100, you know, almost 4 times. South America and Caribbean. That's almost 4 times. Everybody's almost 4 times. This increase here, that's about, if you annualize it, that comes out to about 1.5%. But the point here is that you're getting a lot more. The population is aging. And they say here, kind of the punchline, the size of the world's population isn't just growing in absolute numbers. It's growing as a share of the overall total. In 2021, 1 in 10 people worldwide were over 65. By 2050, that's likely to be around 1 in 6. So no question the population is growing, but the older population is growing in other continents, not so much in the U.S. and North America.
So the immigration is a major contribution to keeping the numbers in the U.S. much younger.
Is that right?
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So basically, you're pulling in a whole bunch of people you don't have to raise and educate, but you're bringing them in young enough to dramatically lower the numbers. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's number one. But number two, I'll tell you who's got the biggest problem on the planet is China.
Yeah.
I told you, when I looked at the pension fund study, we had $25 trillion of pension fund assets behind our aging population. They had $1 trillion, and they have a much bigger number and much worse than we do. So China's got a real problem on their hands. Right.
But that's kind of a longer-term problem. I mean, I think we have bigger problems shorter-term. We need to all bets are off on aging population and all that going forward because the maniacs are in control. The psychopaths are in control. You know,
right. And the maniacs are very committed to depopulation. So.
Absolutely. They could change population figures overnight.
Right. And I hate to say this, they have the software and analytical capability that when, I mean, if you look at how they're managing this, it's one person at a time. So, you know, think of all the data that just, you know, now I think the data beast already had that data from Chance long before, you know, it got hacked. But remember, they've got, you know, anything you put online or your doctor puts online digitally, they've got. And they're using that to do this kind of control.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Let's turn finally to pushback. Some good pushback week from I think the lines on pushback are becoming really clear as we move forward. So we'll see two of those lines here. Number one is the state versus Fed line, and this is a great example. Louisiana Senate passes a bill to end state cooperation with UN and WHO. This is very, very blunt. Louisiana State Senate unanimously passed a bill that would end state and local cooperation with rules and mandates from the WHO and the UN. The proposed law declares the World Health Organization, United Nations, and World Economic Forum shall have no jurisdiction or power within the state of Louisiana. What does that mean? Here's where it gets blunt. No rule, regulation, fee, tax, policy, or mandate of any kind of the World Health Organization, United Nations, and the World Economic Forum shall be enforced or implemented by the state of Louisiana or any agency, department, etc. So we're just not going to enforce any of that. Your laws, basically for you guys, all your laws and your rules and your meddling, it's all null and void here. Bye.
Right. But the problem is the World Health Organization is going to be engineered to work through a federal office. And then it's going to come down to a constitutional issue.
Right.
Do the feds have jurisdiction? Which I would argue they don't. And the question is, how is the state going to deal with that? And I will tell you again and again, this is all going to come down to taxation.
But if you may be right about that, but the point of the states offering resistance is by offering resistance and by forcing the issue, they bring these issues to a head. They bring them front and center. There's no way to duck the conflict now.
Right.
If the states
are
doing
this. The good news here, this is such good news, John, because if you look at it, it was basically a unanimous vote against. What this says is that state legislators are beginning to realize that they are dealing with a force that is this insane and they have to do something. And that is very good news.
Yes. So state versus Fed is one fault line. Another, which we saw earlier with the happiness survey, is liberal conservative. Conservatives eye CBDC vote. This is from Politico. Heritage Foundation's political arm announced it would grade members on their support for a bill from Representative Tom Emmer, a Republican, that would block the Federal Reserve from issuing a CBDC to consumers, either directly or through banks, out of concerns over privacy. We do not want to emulate the Chinese Communist Party, who are using central bank digital currency to literally surveil their population, Emmer told the ABA earlier this month. It's outrageous. The digital dollar is becoming a key issue for conservatives. Yes, it is. Who see it as an inherent threat to civil liberties, to use Heritage's phrasing. Former President Donald Trump in January swore to block any Fed effort to develop a CBDC. And Ted Cruz in February introduced a Senate companion bill to Emmer's. I don't really necessarily trust either one of those gentlemen, but I'm encouraged that there's a whole political arm that's now up in arms about CBDC. That's great.
It is great. It is great. So the turn is upon us. And now think of the war is going to a whole new level, but it's just begun.
Yeah. It's just begun.
The legislatures are finally beginning to realize that CBDC doesn't just replace the small banks. It replaces the legislatures.
Explain that.
A social credit system working through CBDCs or any form of digital, you know, 100%, a 100% digital financial system means all fiscal policies can be implemented, whether it's collection of taxation or expenditure of any governmental resources, and all behavior and all regulations, everything can be enforced through the monetary system. You do not need legislatures. You do not need bureaucracies. You do not need any of that. I'm not saying you'll destroy it because it's useful to have them, like Biden, be the fall gate, right?
Right. So there's three parties. You have the Fed engineering everything. You have Biden as the fall guy. And you have 1,000 Indians in India watching this whole thing and controlling it.
Right. And you have people in Congress fiddling, you know. But they, all legislators and all bureaucracies are stripped 100% of all power. All power goes to the central bankers. And the big question, you know, because if you look at how this is going to work and evolve, exactly how is Jay Powell going to have any power? Because the whole thing can be run from Switzerland, right?
Right. Well, yeah.
Right? Yep. Or Israel. Yep.
Doesn't matter. You know, yeah, right.
Right. You know, you pick the place, but whether it's, you know, whatever the cybersecurity haven is, the monetary side of the house does a complete financial coup of the fiscal side of the house, and they have total control of the fiscal side of the house and can implement it through an all digital system.
Yeah, right. They can play God. From the go-to place of my childhood was they can implement it all from Timbuktu.
Yeah, they just need all the copper in the world. They need to go to space to get more copper from the asteroids to do it.
Right. Exactly. Okay, well, that's it for pushback and for the stories this week. So let's turn to the remaining charts. You've already been through a couple, starting with the 10-year and the 30-year Treasury since the going direct reset.
So you said it earlier, the notion that we're, you know, Powell's going to back off to lower interest rates, I just don't see it. We got everybody in a debt trap. And if you look globally, we certainly can't force our way with land wars, right? So control has to work, as the Italian professor said, through the debt system. And so I just think Powell's got no choice for his position but to play hardball, and we can see interest rates trending back up a little bit. So this is the long rate and the intermediate rate in the Treasury market, and up we go.
Yeah, up.
Right.
Basically without relenting. Okay, next up we have...
That was from the vote of the going direct reset. So what you see is the debt trap is a major, major implementer of the going direct reset. Okay, so here's gold. And there are a couple reasons why gold could shoot up, and it's simply not clear yet. RT announced, that the price control is moving to Asia, and there could be some truth to that. But the other is, if you look at what's happening with the states starting to vote on buying gold or build gold bullion depositories, it may be that Mr. Globalist letting the price, you know, the price float up. We don't know why, but clearly gold and silver just shot up and are outperforming, you know, or have a good chance this year to outperform or match the S&P. And the bloom is off the rose on the AI.
This is, to me, the most amazing chart of the week, more so than the Boeing chart, because this is from the going direct reset. And because you see the enemy to the powers that be here in gold and silver, you know, the labels are not really where they should be. The silver is up 67.7%, and the S&P, I mean, they're basically neck and neck after, 5 years. That's just astonishing to me that you try to implement a control program that much, and you're unable to suppress the price of silver despite your best efforts. That's astonishing.
Well, I'm not sure that. So, you know, if gold is the perfect thing to use to short squeeze all the states, if I can get the states doing gold and silver, you know, and building bullion depositories, and I can implement. You know, you've got these systems now where they're trying to get everybody on MasterCard with or basically card systems to liquefy their gold. Remember, the citizens in the states have no gold, or they have 5%, 5% have gold. They have dollars. if I can implement a system where, you know, I can short squeeze everybody and they only can transact with gold and silver. Because remember, the Constitution allows the states to do gold and silver. If I can short squeeze them into gold and silver, you know, I'm going to have a field. The central bankers are going to have a field day because they have plenty of gold.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
So this may be Mr. Global letting the price start to float up because you're moving the states onto gold and silver. And that is why we had Richard Warner in Nashville last week and then in Knoxville talking to everybody about the importance of dollar liquidity, because otherwise you're going to get put in a short squeeze. So I'm a huge believer in gold and silver, you know, for treasurers to buy gold and silver and have bullion depositories, but they better have a sovereign state bank or some function like that so that everybody can transact their dollars, because otherwise the central bankers are going to come in, they're going to short squeeze with gold, and they're going to do what they did in Russia and Eastern Europe and Latin America. They're going to pick up your real estate cheap. And, you know, if the short squeeze on gold doesn't work, then they'll bring in the WHO and, you know, we'll have pandemics. All the cartels are competing for a patsy story, right?
Yeah. Well, let me get right at my surprise at this chart for another way. And that's this. You and I started doing this podcast about right here.
Right.
And it seems like every week in and week out, we do about charts of these stocks. And the S&P is always up here, and the others, and the high flying stocks are up here, and gold and silver are always in the basement. And as it turns out, after all these years, 5 years of since the going direct reset, silver is within spitting distance of the S&P 500. I just find that astonishing.
Well, you know, over the last year, how many times have you heard me say, I love silver, it's on sale, I'm buying silver?
It's on sale. It's on sale. Right. That's what I hear every week. It's right. Like, I guess the sale wasn't that good. It's a 7% sale over 5%.
I bought a ton of it when it was in the basement, and then now it's flying.
It's down 7% versus the S&P over 5 years. I mean, that's a tie in a foot race.
Right.
Anyway, that's what kind of blows me away.
That's why I was buying silver.
let me keep it going here with the next. Oh, FinViz.
You know, I have to just say this. I was also buying the value stocks, which were also in the basement. So I always like to buy in the basement. So, yeah.
Back to FinViz. We haven't seen FinViz in a while, but it looks like the wallpaper we've come to know and love with the VIX in the basement and the sugar way up, the cocoa and the coffee and the orange juice way at the top.
I emailed Ricardo. I said, you better start stockpiling chocolate bars because, you know, here come the prices.
And then this is interesting. All these currencies clustered in the center.
Isn't that interesting?
Here. Yeah, that is. But man, look at that. Secretariat is comfortably in the lead there. Cocoa.
But look at the bottom. Guess what is it completely in the bottom?
VIX. It's like that forever. There was a 3 week period where it wasn't. That was about it.
But here's the thing. You know, it's very easy to disrespect the central bankers. But if you sit back and look at the long view of how the going direct reset is working,
mm-hmm.
would you say that their engineering is working?
Yeah, pretty much.
Right.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you have the Boeings of the world, and that's a problem. But overall, yeah, the stories work. People still believe the stories. They don't even question the stories. Everything's working. Yeah. The dollar's still strong. Yeah.
If they're angry about what's going on, who do they blame?
Let me say, themselves? No. They blame us.
No?
They blame people.
Well, but
they always blame. They blame the victim every time.
But how many people do you know who blame the central bankers for what is happening?
Oh, no, nobody. Nobody.
Well, not nobody. There's you. There's me.
Yeah. I mean, nobody who reads.
And Amazon, to make the point, an Amazon truck just went by behind you.
Yeah, I'm sure. Every
right.
day.
But I think that's the question. When will we start to understand that our problem is at 33 Liberty Street in New York?
But it's sooner than you might think, though. I think a lot of people are picking up on it.
Okay, good.
It's just the machinations of the monetary system are so opaque. It's hard to track. Okay. Right. Let's go to our last chart, which is visualizing the growth of $100 by asset class. Let me punch in. This is from the Visual Capitalist. Let's punch in on this one. And this goes back to 1970. You can see that. Look at that. S&P 500 up to 22,000 cash. If you...
I want to point out that this includes reinvested dividends.
Okay,
so
fair enough.
So this is not just capital gains. It's reinvested dividends. So in 2014, I had a huge war with so many allies, so many people in the new media. Greg Hunter bet me a dollar. I mean, it was just an all-out war. And I said, you know, they can write down the debt or they can mark up the equity. And I called it Planet Equity. And I said, if I were Mr. Global, I would simply inflate and mark up the equity. And the fight got so mean that the gold bugs, somebody promoted, you know, wrote up one of my interviews and said, you know, this makes sense. The Planet Equity scenario is a logical thing for Mr. Global to do. The gold guys were so mad, they attacked him and made him take it down. I mean, no, it was, when I tell you, I've never experienced that. Even when I was the target of electromagnetic, I've never experienced that kind of isolation as I did in my, you know, it was just all at war. And, but if you look at that chart, that is the Planet Equity scenario. Instead of marking down the debt, you mark up the equity. And that is exactly what has happened. And what you need to understand is that that rise, which is extraordinary from 2014 on, was financed with sovereign government debt, you know, and money stolen out of the U.S. and other, probably other governments. That is, there is a tsunami. And the reason the treasury bonds are down at the bottom, one of the reasons is, you know, your pension funds have been buying treasury bonds to finance that tsunami of debt, which, you know, into that tsunami of the S&P going up. So your pension funds are buying treasury and the money's going out the back door and it's driving the S&P up and it's making the, you know, the top 1% of the 1%, you know, billionaires many times over. And that's the game. It's so clear when you look at this chart.
Yeah, that's a big divergence. Yeah, that you're right. The ones that keep your eye on are the 10-year bond.
Right.
Versus it's S&P 500 10 times higher.
Right.
Over 50 some odd year period.
I suspect from what I know that, you know, all real estate is local. And if you look at the real estate number on that chart, it looks remarkably low, but it very much depends on the location.
It's, you know, it's a thin notch above cash.
Right. But one of the biggest plays on the planet is securitizing real estate into the stock market, which is happening around the world. And we did a wrap up on that, you know, a couple of years ago. But that's part of the play. So I suspect the real estate number is a little low. Anyway,
if that's right, though, and things turn south in real estate, if you're really getting that much of a multiplier, like you're saying, that when this goes down, this goes through the floor. Buy, if you're right about that. Because what you're describing is a leveraged system of real estate. Leverage is an ugly game. When it's going your way, you're borrowing money, you're making.
Right.
That's good. But when you get the margin call,
right,
not so good.
Okay. So the debt growth model can't give you another up. But what can give you another up is sufficient takings if you have the machinery to take.
Yep.
And that's where the UN model comes in. That's where the cybersecurity games come in. That's where the pandemic games come in. And that's where the patsy capitalism comes in. Can you depopulate and take sufficient to keep that line going up? And that's why the game is turning meaner and meaner.
Right. The snake starts eating its tail. Right.
Right. Or your tail.
Right. Right. Okay. That's the last chart. So let's turn to Solarian House. And again, we have news, trends, and stories with Dr. Farrell.
Part one. So part one, we focus on the U.S. fight for financial freedom and what's going on in the U.S. And then part two, we go global with a lot more about Europe and Asia, et cetera. Anyway, so it was a very interesting discussion. I drove out to Oklahoma to do it. And Robert was supposed to come with me, but so I could work while he was driving. But he had to cancel, and so Catherine had to do 38 hours of driving in 1 week. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, wow.
We had a meet and greet in Tulsa, which was, you know, the most fabulous group of people in the world. It was really wonderful, and I want to thank those subscribers. It was a lot of fun.
That's great. Okay, let's keep it going with Hero of the Week.
Yes, South Dakota representative who's been fighting, you know, for financial freedom. And I'm going to be up in South Dakota in May, and I'm looking forward to that. I'm going to get a chance to meet her.
Julie, so, how do you pronounce that last name?
I think it's Ouch. Ouch.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I've been emailing with her, but I forgot to check the pronunciation of her name.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
So she was somebody who just decided I've had it and ran for the House of Representatives. And it just shows you've got real talent coming in.
Wow. That's great. I love
that.
Great. People just get fed up and say, if no one else is going to run, do it. I'll do it.
Yeah.
Okay. Next up, meet and greet. Next one.
Okay.
Again.
So I'm flying to Sandpoint, Idaho tomorrow. And I'm really looking forward to that. We've got 52 people, including some coming from Canada.
Wow.
So, yeah. Yeah.
That's a big number.
So on Friday, I'm going to be meeting with, I think, 11 South Dakota legislative representatives. And then the meet and greet is on Saturday. So,
okay.
It's not too late to sign up. A lot of great people coming. And I can say it because we've had him on the Salary Report, Attorney Matt Hale.
Who was
the guy who wrote that article about, you know, should we really do jury trials by Zoom? Not a good idea.
Right.
So he's one of my favorite people.
Before we get to the last one, we want to talk about publication date next week for Money and Markets.
Yes. So we're going to publish Money and Markets 1 day late. I can hear the screams already. Wait, I need Thursday night. But Catherine has an appointment that cannot be changed. So I'm going over to South Carolina and coming back. And John has been very kind to let us record. I guess we're going to record on Thursday and for publication on Friday. So forgive us, but I need to do that anyway.
Okay. Yeah, I know you wanted to get that off your chest before we get to the last chart. You don't want to forget that and have it be a rude surprise for subscribers. But with that out of the way, let's get to our last in-house Solari with your right to food freedom video shorts.
So we have over 100 of the financial freedom shorts. And of course, you know, when you work in a state legislature, what we're seeing is control of the food is one of the essential controls you need to get to an all digital financial system and basically turn over control of the central bankers. And so food freedom, and you know, it's back to, you saw the story with the chickens this week.
Yeah.
You know, or the loss of the cattle herds in the panhandle from the fires. I mean, it keeps coming up again and again. So we've started to take really great shorts on food and put those up as well. So check those out. There'll be a panel on the homepage where you can click to them as well. And I just have to point out, I got copies from the European printer. We're sending it next week to the US printer. The Dutch farmers and fishermen are out in hard copy. And have you gotten your copy yet, John? Because we FedEx to some people. Okay. We'll make sure we get it to you. But this is
That Amazon truck was loaded with the Salary Report, which I don't imagine.
No,
we don't
ship by Amazon. Okay. I told you this. Did we talk about this story on Money Markets about the Amazon drivers?
No.
So a subscriber in Nashville, outside of Nashville, was moving in. And they had ordered a part from Amazon urgent, something they were putting up required that part. So they were, you know, operationally, it was very urgent that they get it. And they called the guardhouse and said, you know, Amazon is delivering this part. Could you make sure to let them through? So they're in a gated community. And they said, well, you need to know we won't let drivers through unless they have a driver's license. And a lot of the Amazon drivers don't have driver's licenses, so we won't let them through. Yeah, compute that.
Good to know.
Good to know. Okay, anyway, I'll send you the Dutch farmers. This is, if you want to understand what is happening in the European farmers, this explains the whole thing. The subtitle is Local Heroes in the Global War on Our Food and Property Rights. And they are right at the heart of the fight. And And the good news is they've started to realize, oh, we're the same, and what they're trying to do is insane. You know, it's patsy capitalism. They're just trying to use, you know, use all of this climate change and environment as a cudgel to kill us and take our stuff.
Yeah.
And the perfect, you know, the proof of that is the stories we looked at this week on what AI is doing.
Yeah, right.
You know, the notion that this is environmentally intelligent is ridiculous.
That's absurd.
Right. Okay.
Patsy capitalism, you're on the menu.
Get yourself off the menu. You can do it. Okay, John.
Yeah, right.
I will talk to you next week, and we'll be back again next week on Friday. So yeah. Have a great week, and I'll talk to you next week.
All right, Catherine. We'll see you.